good to be a part of a family of God that sees beyond the brick walls. I'm so thankful to the Forest Mill family and for the leadership that has brought us to this. And I wished I could take credit for it, but I just get to walk into it and be a part of what you all are already doing. I'm so thankful for that. You may have heard this on the radio, big news, or you've seen it on TV, but today is, the significance of today. Today is National Text Your Preacher Day, as we consider our series on Jesus. And so, it's really big. So this is what I want you to do. Normally, I'm telling everybody to put away your smartphones and all that stuff. But here's the deal. I need to get your phone numbers and everything. This is just so much easier. If you don't want me to have your phone number, you don't have to send it to me. Or you can send me a phone number with someone else's name, and it'll just be a joke. I don't know. Text me your name to my phone. Here's my phone number. It's still got a 615, but I don't think you have to pay long distance for texting. So if you don't have a cell phone, don't text me your home phone number. Oh, man, I forgot to turn off my... Hold on just a second. I need to put that on. So my phone will be vibrating all through my pocket here. Yeah. Text me your phone number, and then I'm going to make sure I have that. I can, you know, call you out through the week or whatever. I need to do with that. But it's good. It's just so much easier than me going through the directory and trying to add. So this is a big deal. For me to be able to have access to y'all's numbers. If I already have yours, you don't have to do it. This is one thing. If you need to write this number down or anything, do that, because I'm fixing to change slides. And here's one more thing that I'm going to ask you while you have your smartphones out or while you have your cell phones out. I am really excited about some of the projects that we are involved in, but congregational events require a lot of coordination, a lot of passing out information. And we have set up an account with this app called Remind. Now, I'm going to tell you, you do not have to get the app to be a part of this. All you have to do is this. You text that number, like that's the number you're calling, 81010, and then you will enter as a message at Forest Mill with one L, just exactly like that. You will send that to me. I mean, that will come to me, and then it will say, you know, you're now to the Forest Mill group. Send D. Welch your name. Then you'll enter your first and last name, and you will be added to the group. Now, anytime we need to get information out to the congregation, whether it's about one day or whether it's about, you know, services have been canceled because there's flooding in the basement or whatever. We don't have a basement. But, you know, if we did, a snow day, or if someone is sick, or we need to want everybody to be praying for certain situations, we can send one message and it would go out to all of you. Just so you know, your name, your phone number, none of your information goes to anyone. That's the beauty of this app. It will also ask you if you would like to add this app. You can if you want, but you do not have to, okay? Once you will get to a point where after you send your name, it will say, you can add this. And you can if you'd like. There's nothing wrong with doing that, but you do not have to do that in order to receive the information. All that will sort of blind carbon copy to where if you want to reply, go to everyone. I don't even think it comes to me. This is a one-way, just sort of a shout-out bulletin board. This is the new phone tree. This is the phone tree for texters, okay? Is the way this sort of works. Anything else I would... Oh, yes, yeah, yes. You will be a student, Padawan. I am the teacher, not because... I'm the one who set up the account, and I'll try to add a couple of other people as teachers so that we can send information out. You will be a student. Thank you for reminding me about that. Or you can be a parent, either one, if you feel more comfortable being a parent. I don't really care. It all works the same. It would all come to you anyway. Everybody got it? 81010 at Forest Mill with one L. Okay. Now, we're going to be continuing through the Gospel of John. This is completely unrelated, but as we get to know Jesus through this biography we have in the book of John, my prayer is that we're getting a more accurate picture of who Jesus is. But the truth is that you didn't come into this series, I didn't come into this series with like a blank slate about who Jesus is, right? You already think you know who he is. You already have these preconceived notions, these preconceived ideas. And I'm no exception. I came with baggage. You know, we always do. And we make it sound like it's a bad thing. It's not always a bad thing. But you already have these ideas about who Jesus is. And one of the images that's most engraved in my mind about the identity of Jesus goes all the way back to my childhood, and it looks something like this. Anybody remember this picture or one like it? Jesus with the little kids. Man, yes, I remember I had a little New Testament Bible, and this was one of the images, or very similar to one of the images that I remember being pictured on one of the pages in there. And based it on images like these and you know, similar type images, we can kind of see Jesus as like a lovable uncle. You know, the uncle who loves kids and who makes you laugh. Maybe you didn't have an uncle like this. I did. You know, the lovable uncle who loves kids, who makes you laugh, who maybe gives you candy when your parents aren't around. You know, shh, don't tell your mom. You know, I'm going to give you a peppermint. Like that my mom was still against peppermints or something. I don't know. But, you know, just kind of just like this really nice guy, not a disciplinarian, not someone to straighten you out, just a good friend. And it's true, by the way. It's true. Jesus loved children. And based on what we read in the gospel accounts, you know, children apparently love Jesus. And children don't love people who are mad at them all the time. So Jesus was good-natured. He did love kids. And so in a way, this image is true. I'm not trying to discount that in the least. But here's the thing. That is not the whole truth. It's true, but it's not the whole truth. Because Jesus, like us, he had multiple sides to him, right? I'm not saying Jesus was two-faced or that he was putting on a show for some people and he was real with us. No. I don't think Jesus was disingenuous or anything like that. But Jesus could be sad. He could be frustrated. He could even be angry, right? Jesus was not like this all the time with everybody. He went through the normal range of human emotions. And we say, we know Christians are not supposed to get angry, or at least that's what's kind of said, what they say. But Jesus gets into so much of a rage that he turns over tables in the temple and worse. So we have to ask the question, this is kind of our central question for the day, is what makes Jesus angry? And we probably ought to contrast that, by the way, with what it is that makes us angry. But we'll get to that later. But what is it that really makes Jesus angry? And our story is recorded in the Gospel of John, but it's not just recorded in John. It's also recorded in the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. This is one of the rare stories one of the rare events that is recorded in all four Gospels. And so right away we have to acknowledge that in some way this, to all of those who were writing about Jesus, to all of them, this event really says something about Jesus. They're all telling a story about Jesus so you can understand who Jesus is. But to every one of them, this story was really important for your understanding and my understanding about Jesus' identity, right? So we have to acknowledge that this is a really important story in understanding who Jesus is. And it's likely a familiar story to many of you. You've probably heard it hundreds of times, maybe. And I have to confess, though, I've always been a little mystified by this story. Like, I read this story, or I hear this story, I hear sermons about this story, and I wonder, what is it that makes Jesus so mad? Because I don't really understand why Jesus was so angry. So let's just read the story for ourselves. It comes from John chapter 2, beginning at verse 13. If you've got your Bibles, you can read those. If you've got your cell phone, use your Bible apps, pull those out. John chapter 2, beginning at verse 13. It was nearly time for the Jewish Passover celebration, so Jesus went to Jerusalem. In the temple, and by the way, just for clarification's sake there, there's a difference between the temple and the temple area. The temple was the building. The temple area would include the complex of the outer courtyards that surrounded it. So in the temple area, Jesus saw merchants selling cattle, sheep, and doves for sacrifices. He also saw dealers or money changers at tables exchanging for money. And Jesus made a whip from some ropes and chased them all out of the temple. What does Jesus do? He chased them out of the temple. He drove out the sheep and cattle. He scattered the money changers' coins all over the floor, and he turned over their tables. Just soak that in. Imagine someone coming into our auditorium this morning and performing those, well, okay, I probably wouldn't drive cattle out, but you get the idea. It would be quite the ruckus, right? Surrounding our worship time, you'd think if somebody came in with a whip, started flipping over chairs and driving people out of the building, this is a big scene. And then going over to the people who sold doves, he told them, get these things out of here. Stop turning my Father's house into a marketplace. So that's the story. But what were these people doing that was so wrong? You know, why was Jesus so angry? But what was so wrong with this scene to make him angry? Was it the selling of the animals for sacrifice? You know, what was that about? What's going on here with the selling of animals for sacrifice? Well, it's Passover. So Jews all come to Jerusalem. The thing is, most don't live around Jerusalem. They have to come from long distances. Remember when the Romans conquered the Jewish people, conquered Palestine, they spread them out parts of the Roman Empire. Many of these Jews are traveling from the far corners of the Roman Empire. And if you're traveling all the way from Italy to Jerusalem, it's just not really practical to carry a goat, is it? Or bring live doves in a cage and keep them alive on a whole trip there. It's just not a feasibility. So what would happen was that these people would arrive in Jerusalem and they needed to make sacrifices. I mean, God explicitly tells the sacrifices that are associated with Passover, explicitly tells them about the sacrifices they need to make for different situations in their lives. And if you get there, and if you don't have animals, but you want to sacrifice like God says, you got to get them somewhere. So just as a practical way of working this out, people who lived in and around Jerusalem became like, you know, farmers or ranchers. They would raise extra goats, extra sheep, extra cattle, extra doves, all of the animals that were required for sacrifice. You just kind of farm those. And when these festivals came around, you'd bring them into the city and you'd set up a system and sell them. It was a service to the people who were coming to worship. And it was, by the way, it was generally accepted, and nobody had a problem with the fact that this was the way it worked out. So if that's not a problem, maybe it was the money changers, right? Maybe that's what really spurred Jesus on, was the fact that you guys are exchanging money. What's that all about? Well, again, every year when faithful Jewish men came to Jerusalem for the big feasts, they were required to pay an annual temple tax. It's a one-time tax. It wasn't a huge sum of money. It was essentially a piece of silver, or in the case of the coinage they were probably using, it was actually half a piece of silver. So they'd go in with someone else and they'd say, this is R2. They'd give one coin to pay for two people's temple tax. But where you're coming from, where they were coming from, they were the coins that they had access to, the coins they were used to using, were the Roman coins. And on the Roman coins is the image of the emperor, the image of Caesar. And that was not acceptable, not an acceptable coin to use for your temple tax. Because it's like paying, it's basically calling Caesar God and giving that money to Yahweh God. You know, this just kind of doesn't really jive there. So you couldn't use that coin to pay temple tax. You had to use another coin. And generally, what we believe they used was called a Tyrian coin. And it was a coin that did not have an image of worship on there. And some believe it didn't have an image at all. But nonetheless, it was the accepted coin to pay tax. It was pure in silver. One coin would pay for two people. It just kind of worked out well. So they would come in with their coins or whatever coins they had access to, and they would exchange them for the right money to pay their temple tax. Again, this practice was generally accepted. Nobody had a problem with it. It was a practical way to do what they needed to do. So if it was okay to sell animals for sacrifice, and if it was okay to exchange money to pay the temple tax, what was it that spurred Jesus into this rage? What was it that made him so angry about this whole scene? Well, I'm going to give you two explanations why I believe Jesus became angry with these merchants, these moneylenders. And it all starts, number one, it all starts with corruption. This fact is made a lot clearer in the other Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, and John doesn't outright say this, but in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we read Jesus, when he's throwing them out, he says, you know, it's written, my Father's house, or my house shall be a house of prayer, but you have turned it into a house of robbers. He's accusing these merchants and these moneylenders of basically ripping people off. And that certainly seems to be a part of the case. There does seem to be corruption present. So instead of paying the normal price for love and getting the normal exchange rate for money, these guys were jacking up the price, kind of like going into a place that's facing a hurricane, loads of plywood and selling them for $200 a sheet. You know what we call that? Yeah, it's basically practical extortion. And that maybe that's what's going on here. And that's to be the case. And so when you pair corruption with religion, it's a particularly nasty piece of work. And what you get when you corruption with religion, you get this religious manipulation. For example, the merchants would take advantage by manipulating the scriptures of God, and where they would say, you know, God says to sacrifice whole perfect animals. And so what a good salesman would do with that passage would be, and I use good in the term, but what a good salesman would do with the passage that was imply like, if you do not buy this perfect animal at the price I'm selling, then God will not bless it and will not bless you. Another implication is that God will curse. If you don't buy my perfect animal at my perfect price, God's not going to bless you. What they were saying is that if you don't do what I'm telling you, God's not going to be with you. He's not going to accept your sacrifice. Can you see the manipulation? Can you see the logic and the evilness that's behind this? For all of you engineers out there, this is a classic case of if-then-else logic. Right? A sort of example is this. If I tell you all this morning, if you stand on one leg and put one hand in your pocket and raise your other hand up to heaven and shout hallelujah, I can't do this for long, so you gotta do it now. If you do that, God will bless you. Else, and this bit's always important, else he will not bless you. Right? I.e., he will curse you. So, can you see how this can be abused? If I were to tell you all, if I'm in a position of some of respect or authority over you, and I don't pretend that I am, but if I were, I could get you to do something that might make you look silly, might take advantage of you. Can you see how people who are desperate for nothing more than to please God in worship are the most ready victims? The people who want nothing more than to please God, those are your best targets because they'll pay anything. And the discouraging thing is that I still hear this kind of talk today, really. And it's wrong. And it builds barriers between people and the church. It builds barriers between lost people and the God of their salvation. When we start, or when anyone starts telling people, if you do this, God will bless you. If you don't, won't. When you start laying those out, it is just a huge stumbling block. It's why some people leave the church. It's why some people never go to church. And when I hear someone saying, you should, first off, I treat that statement with the contempt it deserves. That is not a statement worthy of a follower of Jesus. And if that's what's being said today, you can imagine what it was like all those years ago, the abuse that was taking place in the house of the Lord, and why Jesus was so angry. It's completely against the New Testament, where God says He is going to bless us because of Jesus Christ and nothing else. You know why God's going to bless you? It's not because you're good. It's not because you wear nice clothes on Sunday morning. It's not because you're a good mom or dad or son or daughter. Not because you work hard at work. It's not because you brush your teeth. I don't know what you think. God is not going to bless for any of those things. You know why God is going to bless you? It's because of what He did through His Son, Jesus Christ. And there is nothing you can do to make you more deserving or less deserving of that blessing, but you are equally undeserving with the rest of us. So Jesus is so mad at these people who are representing God, because how can He preach the love of God and what God is going to do through Him in these other people who represent God are extorting them and abusing them and taking advantage of them? You got two competing voices there. Jesus, who's saying God's trying to bless you, and these other people saying, yeah, God will bless you if you do it my way. In that noise, the love of God's difficulty being heard. So Jesus silences the other voice. It would be like me trying to tell you, your house is on fire, you have to get out, and someone else yelling in your ear, no, there's dangerous gas outside, don't go outside. You know, you got two people giving two different messages, and you're stuck in the middle. You're like, I don't know what to do. Should I go outside because the house is on fire? Should I stay inside because there's poisonous gas out there? So Jesus silences the wrongful voice and says, no, it's okay. God loves you. So Jesus couldn't preach about this loving God under those circumstances. He actually is referencing a passage from Isaiah chapter 14, verse 21, where it says, and there shall no longer be traitors in the house of the Lord of hosts on that day. And Jesus has ushered in that day. So Jesus drove them out of the temple for religious manipulation. But there's another reason too, and it's one that likely we won't pick up on unless we're just really familiar with the temple. So up here I've got a picture of what the temple looked like. This is not a photograph, but it was a rendering from someone who was there at the time. This is what the temple looked like during the day of Jesus. This is the Herodian temple, the temple that was fixed up by King Herod and expanded under his sons. Anyway, so here's a diagram of the what the temple looked like. Right here, this is the temple. Oh, sorry. I can't press two buttons at once. This temple proper, right? Inside there is the holy place and the holy of holies. All that's up in here. Out in here, this is the women's court. Jewish women could enter here. Up here is the men's court. It's out in front of the temple. Men could go in there to worship. Women had to stay to worship. And all this area out here, this outlying, inside the colonnades, Solomon's porch out there, see that outer wall? Inside this big courtyard. And that's called the court of the Gentiles, because the Gentiles could not enter these gates to go. They couldn't go into the women's court, obviously. And the men could not go. Jewish. They were Gentiles. So if they wanted to worship God, they had to do it out here. And that's the way the temple was sort of set up. But by Jesus' day, this temple was a place of worship, like a Jewish nationalistic stronghold, a place where Gentile worship was obstructed, which runs exactly counter to what that temple was set up to do. You see, all the way back when it was the Solomon, his vision for the temple, all the way back in the Old Testament when it was established, all the way back in Isaiah's day when he was talking about, he wanted his house to be called a house of prayer, not for Israel, but for all of the nations. God be a place where everyone can come and worship. This is not about a Jewish identity. It's not about the national state of Israel. This is about everybody coming to worship me. We're setting up and selling sacrificial animals. Where do you think the livestock was set up? Where do you think the money changers had set booths? Right out here in the court of the Gentiles. So if you were a Gentile who wanted to worship God, how could you? You couldn't. This was ills. This was the Jewish people. This was the rejection of the Gentiles. We don't care if you want to come to our God. He's our God, and you stay out. That sort of possessive, my God, not your. If you've ever had a kid, you know, you have maybe a toddler, and then you have another baby come along, and then the baby starts like getting some of mom and dad's affection. You know how that goes? And then the toddler says something about like, no, this is my daddy. This is my mommy. That's what the Jews were doing. You can't have my father. You can't worship my God. This is my God, not your God. So by doing this, by setting up the money changers, by setting up the merchants right out there, they had effectively torpedoed Gentile worship in the only place that was open for them to worship. And that's what flew in the face of God and Jesus' desire for the temple to be a place of worship for everyone. So that, there are two reasons why I think this text is really important for us this morning. First, just like in those days, we are surrounded by gross injustice, by great suffering, and that is not okay. Following the lead of Jesus, we are authorized to be passionate about the destructiveness of evil that causes suffering. That's what Jesus was doing. He was angry about the injustice and the suffering that was going on there. And so Jesus has led us to have a different value system from the whole rest of the world and led us to be passionate about injustice, led us to be passionate about evil. We are there. We need this disturbing story about Jesus filled with rage at the unfairness of what was going on in the name of God to encourage us to be passionate in the battle against evil. And I so appreciated Steve's prayer earlier this morning, and I started to use that very picture, the picture of the little boy named Omar Dakhnish. And he was 4 or 5 years old. He was in a building that was bombed by the Syrian government. And in the picture, his older brother, his 10-year-old brother, has they found out now died. And this little boy is just completely ash-covered. He's got blood coming down over this side of his face. And he's sitting there completely shell shock. I mean, his whole body, his whole system, his whole world is in shock, and he's just sitting there in this hospital stretcher looking so despondent. And if you're not mad at that, if you're not upset at the injustice of what's going on in the world of little boys like that all over the world, there's something wrong with you. We ought to be a people who are passionate about that injustice. And here's what makes me really mad is that some of our politicians are bragging about the fact that we're trying to keep those people out. No, y'all stay there. That just doesn't sound like Jesus talked to me. Yeah, I feel bad that y'all are suffering, but y'all are most. So the Christian response is, deal with it. That makes me so angry that they resent my Jesus that way. That is not the God I serve. And if we sit back and aren't outraged at that injustice, if we aren't angry with that evil, we're no better than the money lenders. We're no better than the merchants standing up in the temple. We have torpedoed their access to Christ. So there's the first thing. We're angry about that. Let me throw in one word of caution. Because I'll tell you, I like to be right, and it's mostly because I'm always right. I like to be right. I like to crack the whip like Jesus did when people disagree with us. But we have to really exercise caution when we feel that righteous rage on. You are not feeling righteous rage when someone disagrees with you every time. You're not feeling righteous rage when you don't get your way. You're not feeling righteous rage when someone cuts you off in traffic, though that is close. Right? Just because things aren't going your way does not mean it's a righteous rage. A righteous rage, as expressed by Jesus here, is the barriers, erecting barriers between people and God. Okay? So let's just be clear about that. The second reason I think we need to hear the story is completely different, but I think equally important is that we need this story, we need to hear about it because it tells us what he was about. Remember, John is just telling us, using the first seven or eight stories in his book to say, okay, here's these stories. I want you to get this and you'll see Jesus. You'll understand who Jesus is. This is his identity. So Jesus here is telling us what his whole mission is about. Jesus came to give people access to God regardless. He came to give us this unfettered access to God that I'm not going to let anyone or anything or any practice or anything that's going on, I'm not going to let that stand between you and your God. Jesus came to give us this 100%, 100% of the time, 100% of the situation, came to give us this full access to God. And we need to be passionately engaged in God's struggle against evil. That's really important. But we also need to know that this uncorrupt temple in the person of Jesus Christ is walking around and available to you wherever you are, whatever's going on with your situation. You have access to that temple all the time. And there's no one, nothing, or anyone, or any practice that can stand between you and your worship of your God. There's nothing that can stand between you and your prayer to your most sovereign leader. That is the good news of Jesus this morning, is that he's not going to let anything come between you and him. That's the beauty of this story. And it's why it never made sense to me before that I just got that Jesus was angry. But I didn't understand he was angry because there was a barrier between me and him that he was getting out of the way. The same way a parent who now has access to their child, or who didn't have access to their child, might get angry at not being able to be with them. Right? Jesus was angry about that. So that's the Jesus we serve. That's the angry God that sometimes people paint him out to be. That's not true. He is a righteous and loving God who gets angry when righteousness and love are not demonstrated. So this morning, if we can help you, bring you back into the presence of God, if you're already a Christian, if you're not a child of God, and you're ready to follow this kind of Jesus, this is the God that you want to serve. We want to invite you to come now. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?